Before I begin, just a note of personal privilege this morning. Sometimes when you are struggling for that which is most important, in the heat of battle, you can sometimes lose sight of who are your allies and who are your enemies. And so since Councilman Stokes is here this morning, I want it not to go unsaid that this unprecedented agreement that is currently on the table of our city council for to be finalized, we wouldn't have that if it weren't for Chairman Stokes and his championing, first of all, Sagamore coming to the negotiating table, and then secondly, being in the room and supporting people of good faith and goodwill coming together to work together for the best of the future of our city. So regardless of times when strategy may differ, trust that we will arrive at the same place together. I know I do. And thank you, Councilman, for your good work. Hear now these words from Luke's Gospel, the 15th chapter. Now all the tax collectors and sinners were coming near to listen to him, and the Pharisees and the scribes were grumbling and saying, "This fellow welcomes sinners and eats with them." So he told them this parable: "Which one of you, having 100 sheep and losing one of them, does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the one that is lost until he finds it? When he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders and rejoices. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and neighbors, saying to them, 'Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep that was lost.' Just so I tell you, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. Or what woman, having 10 silver coins, if she loses one of them, does not light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? When she has found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, 'Rejoice with me, for I have found the coin that I had lost.' Just so I tell you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents." Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Please pray with me. O Lord, uphold me that I may uplift thee. Amen. So I was talking to a newcomer to our church this week, someone who grew up in Baltimore, who was telling me how he moved back home from a place not too far from here. It was gorgeous, he told me, describing the clean streets, friendly neighbors that he encountered every day, safe, almost idyllic place where he had been living. Well, if it was so great, why did you move back? I asked. He paused and thought hard for a moment, shook his head, and said, "Being from Baltimore, it just didn't feel right." His comment took me back last year to a rainy fall evening. Kate and I had just left dinner after having one of those serious spousal check-in times, one where we ask each other, "How are you really doing? And are we still called to be here in Baltimore? We've been here almost 12 years. How are you feeling about it?" Well, how are you feeling about it? It was a good conversation as we were driving into the dark, rainy night, miserable by just about any standard. Kate was reflective, almost wistful. "I'm just not sure," she ventured, "what it is about Baltimore that grabs you." Just as she finished the sentence, we rounded a corner to find a man standing in the middle of a Hamden neighborhood street, soaking wet in his white t-shirt, cheering, both hands raised in a concert-like salute, screaming to no one in particular. "That's it," I said, pointing at the man. "That's what grabs you." Living or working or worshiping in our city, it's almost impossible to get arrogant about anything. We can't gloat over our sports teams, at least not often enough to make us as annoying as New York. Poverty is disproportionately high. 40% of our streets are labeled substandard. And I heard recently that we just made the top 10 list for the most unattractive people in America. I'm glad I could help you with that one. As much as I and many of you long for systemic change in our home, I love the fact that we couldn't be pretentious if we wanted to. It's like we are all part of one big AA meeting, one where we have to admit first and foremost that we're powerless to get ourselves out of the big mess that we're all a part of before we are able to realize the power of God to change ourselves. Those big messes of segregation, of middle class and white flight, and the devastated economy that helped set all of that in motion, of the lack of trust in government, not only here but around the country, the drugs, the guns, the violence, the death. I do know that some people are glad to leave that mess, those who have the choice to do so. Some people absolutely need to get out for their own mental health, head to a place with cleaner streets, friendly neighbors, safe, almost idyllic. Everyone deserves a break from that mess, though not everyone has the means to get that break. But there is something about not having to pretend that your home is whole. There is something about knowing that you cannot deceive others, much less yourself, about the truth of the world that you inhabit and your own place in it that makes it, I think, easier to encounter God and maybe easier to really encounter each other. That's the way I think it must seem for that one sheep that is lost in the wilderness, that one sheep that finds itself alone and helpless. It knows that it is in danger in the wilderness. The rest of the sheep don't seem to recognize that they are just as vulnerable. The text makes clear that they are in the wilderness too. 100% of those sheep are in the wilderness. All of them are subject to the dangers of the land, the dangers of predators, the potential for death. But it's not clear to me that the 99 know that about themselves. It seems more likely that they take for granted the fact that someone is leading them through that wilderness. Someone is protecting them and guiding them, making sure that they have food and water. It's easy not to notice the shepherd, when you are surrounded with everything that you need, with food and water and companions. It's easy to fail to recognize that you are still in the wilderness, still vulnerable, still the beneficiary of guidance and provision and protection that you did not earn. Which is exactly what the religious leaders do according to Luke. They see the tax collectors and sinners, and they grumble to themselves, saying, "This fellow welcomes sinners and eats with them." They grumble because they don't think of themselves as any wilderness. They don't think of themselves as in any need of support. They don't think of themselves as deficient. Quite the opposite. They think of themselves as better. This seems to be the temptation that Jesus warns against again and again in Luke's gospel, the temptation to point out the speck in your neighbor's eye but miss the log that is in your own, the temptation to think that God cares more about holding right opinions or practicing the correct rituals or supporting the right causes more than God cares for actual people that hold all of those opinions and practice all of those rituals and believe in all those causes. So you get a little bit of money and you look around and think to yourself, it's all because of my work ethic or my talent that I'm wealthier than others. Or you get a little more education and think to yourself, I know more about what my neighbor needs than she knows herself. Or you get a little more spiritual acumen and think to yourself, I am so much more enlightened than most. Jesus challenges the religious leaders around their arrogance towards sinners and tax collectors. He doesn't defend either of them. Tax collectors were Jews who collected taxes on behalf of their Roman occupiers. They made wealth off the oppression of their own people, which is why they were so hated and considered traitors by their own people. Jesus doesn't defend their actions. Sinners were those who had broken religious law. Jesus doesn't defend them either. He simply states that God goes after lost people. God tracks them down and brings them home. God doesn't give up on them. But notice the challenge to those religious leaders. Which one of you, having 100 sheep and losing one of them, does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the one until he finds it? Which one of you? I think Jesus knows that most human shepherds with common sense would not leave 99 compliant sheep, those who are doing exactly what they are supposed to do, to go after one that is lost. He knows that the religious leaders' attention is with those they've declared righteous, not with those who are lost. They wouldn't leave the 99, and if we are honest, most of us wouldn't leave them either. Now, I think the church has tended to pile that truth on as a judgment on all of us, and the effect becomes a pressure for us to go after the lost, to pressure us to be more like God, to pressure us toward more self-improvement. But pointing out the truth of sin's reach seems to miss the extraordinary good news that Jesus is trying to announce, that God's grace knows no bounds. God doesn't give up on anyone, no matter how lost, no matter how broken, no matter how hurt. Wherever there is pain and suffering and injustice and oppression in our world, you can be sure that God is already there. Which is extraordinary good news if you are living in a place that is clearly lost, or if you have enough humility about yourself to know that there are some parts of you that are lost as well. There is no human being who is as generous and loving and as persistent as God. God doesn't give up on you. God doesn't give up on me. God doesn't give up on us. The real question, according to Jesus, is not can you match God? It's not can you match God, but can you celebrate that news whenever you see it? Can you celebrate that news whenever you see it? Rejoice with me, the shepherd tells his friends and neighbors. I've found my sheep that was lost. Rejoice with me, the woman in the second parable tells her friends and neighbors, for I have found the coin that was lost. Rejoice with me. It is the only command that I can find in these two stories. Not an admonition to do more or to be more, just an invitation to rejoice at the extravagance of God's grace. The trouble with religious leaders in particular, Jesus implies, is not that we don't go after tax collectors or sinners. It's not that we haven't done what we ought to do. It's that we can't seem to celebrate mercy that is undeserved, grace that is unearned, love that doesn't play by our rules. Justice to them is about making someone else pay, making someone else fall, making someone else hurt. But justice for God seems more about drawing the circle wider, bringing more and more people back into it, restoring relationships that maybe human beings are incapable of restoring on their own. You know, coming out of the city council meeting on Thursday, it was hard for me to catch any glimpses of any circles like that. I watched a white man shouting down Glenna Huber, the Episcopal priest who serves with me as Build's co-chair, the vitriol on his face directed at this African-American female religious leader. And my friend reminded me of videos of some of the Trump rallies that I've seen. The content of the politics were surely different, but the hate felt exactly the same. There were some compelling arguments, to be sure, on the other side of the table made by some very good people whom I deeply respect. Maybe we should have pushed for more inclusion in the affordable housing and less on the local hiring mandates. Maybe we should have pushed more on wages and less on affordable housing. Maybe we could have gotten more than $135 million and that pipeline of jobs so desperately needed for our city's most disenfranchised residents. But I couldn't help but wonder if what made people the angriest was to see religious leaders sitting at a table with notorious tax collectors and sinners, to see us consort with people you're not supposed to consort with, to argue and wrestle with people you are supposed to know only as symbols and stick figures, not as actual people. To see us deliver real benefit to the city's most vulnerable, but at the expense of our own perceived purity and righteousness. There are times when the most prophetic thing that the church can do is to speak truth to power, to tell it like it is. I surely believe that. But I've also discovered a different kind of prophetic role of the church, to share a table with people you think don't deserve to be there. And in a post-9/11 world, perhaps that kind of prophecy is more important than ever. Or as one of our recent high school graduates texted to his mom by way of encouragement, tell Andrew that from what I've seen in the world, at least in this election cycle, the true believers need compromisers more than the compromisers need true believers. It's easier to stomach that loss of your self-righteous veneer if you already understand yourself to be a guest at that table, way less than perfect, vulnerable, and in need of God's grace. It's easier, I think, if you live in a city where perfection would seem fake the minute you ran into it. It's easier if you already consider yourself part of one great big AA meeting where everybody starts with the same admission that we are all a mess, powerless to change without God's grace, God's amazing, unmerited, extravagant grace that never gives up on any of us.